Thank you. Hi. My name is Winona. I'm an alcoholic. So I used to drink a lot. Can you imagine? I think I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll tell you that my sobriety date is February 8th, 2002. I got sober in Phoenix, Arizona, and I drank a lot for a long time before I stopped. And I have a home group in Gloucester, Virginia. It's called Fellowship of the Spirit. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. My sponsor's sponsor has a sponsor. So I try to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all of my affairs to the best of my ability. And I go with, I try to start with that. So I'll start with that. I drank a lot. I already told you that. So this is how I drank. I was the kind of person that if you went into a bar and they had a sign that said, all you can drink for a dollar, I would say, give me $2 worth. You know, I didn't drink like a lady. I always wanted more, whatever it was. If I drank all mine, I'd take yours. And I really did do that. I don't just say that for effect. I wasn't very nice about my drinking. I just wanted to get drunk, and the faster the better. So I'll tell you a couple of things that happened that in Phoenix. They told me that when you tell a story about something you did when you were in your heavy drinking, that it qualifies us as an alcoholic. So I'll tell you a couple of things that qualify me as an alcoholic. My earliest memory of, I guess I should say, I kind of interrupt myself sometimes. I grew up in New England. I grew up in a little town in Massachusetts. I have two brothers and a sister. I had a mom and dad. We were kind of middle class white neighborhood growing up in the 60s and 70s. And I lived in a small town. We bragged because we had our own zip code. And my older brother and my little sister never drank or drugged or did anything like that because they thought it was a problem. And my other brother and I, we didn't think it was a problem. We thought something was wrong with them, you know. So my earliest memory with alcohol, my very earliest memory, I was probably about 6 or 7, and my parents had this big New Year's Eve party. And I lived in a big Victorian house on top of a hill, and my parents would invite everybody. They had kind of an open door policy, so there were probably about 100 people at my house. And my friend and I think we were in our pajamas, and there were tables like this. And we went around the house, and every time we found a cup, if there was anything in the cup, we poured it into another cup. And we kept doing that until we had a full cup. And then we went in the den and hid under the table and drank it to see what would happen. So I'm just telling you, like, you know, like a good alcoholic, and I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I was just a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Let's see what it will do to us. And so that was kind of began my pattern of drinking like an alcoholic. When I was 12, my brother and I stole some Seagram 7 out of my dad's liquor cabinet. My dad was not an alcoholic. And neither was my mother. And so they had a liquor cabinet, and you know, the liquor that was in there might have been in there for 3 or 4 years and or more. You know, it wasn't an issue for them. But my brother and I knew that there was some liquor in there, and so in our great brilliance, we took a bottle of Seagram 7. I don't recommend that, but we didn't know any better. So we took Seagram 7, which is awful, awful stuff. And we looked in the pantry and we found some Chex cereal. I guess we weren't very clever. So we took some Chex cereal in the box and a bottle of Seagram 7 and we snuck into the drive-in. And I don't really remember anything about the drive-in, but I do remember that when I woke up to get from our house to the drive-in through the woods, was a creek with a broken dam. And we used, when I was growing up, we spent a lot of time down there. We called it the Broken Dam. And I woke up on the dam, and I had vomit on my, coming out my nose and on my face. And I'm telling you that because I survived. And some people don't survive that. You know, that's how some people die. And I just thought that I just didn't do a very good job and that I should try harder. You know, like, I mean, I don't think normal people really think like that, but that is how I thought. You know, like, oh, I just better try harder next time. So, and there were a lot of next times. So a little while later, I was going somewhere with some friends, and it was somebody's birthday, and we had tequila, and the tequila was under my seat, and somebody said, "We're going to get the tequila and pass it around." And I reached down, and I could tell there was a bottle, and I passed it around, and I reached down again, I could tell there was another bottle, and I drank the second bottle. And I just wasn't smart enough not to. So I'm not saying, you know, see, I was all that because I drank. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I didn't know better not to. So I almost died that night because I had alcohol poisoning from the tequila. So again, my parents had this big party. You know, they like to do that. And this wasn't New Year's. It was a different time. And the guy that I had ridden in his car and drank that tequila and thrown up in his car, the next morning, my mom wanted that guy to go to the store and get donuts for all the people who had spent the night. And he didn't know where the donut shop was, so he asked him, she came and told me that I had to take him to the donut shop in his car. And then I really thought I was going to die, because I had to go back in that car, and I still can remember hanging my head out the window trying not to have to be in that car, you know, because it was bad. It was bad news. So so those are some of the things I did when I was a child. As I got older, I didn't like learn better behavior, not really. I went in the Air Force when I was 19, and I went to Incirlik, Turkey, and our first sergeant decided that it would be good for morale if they built a bar in the day room in the barracks, and he asked me if I wanted to be a bartender. That worked fine for me. So I don't remember getting in trouble when I was in Turkey, but I do remember my first sergeant suggesting to me that maybe I had a problem with alcohol. And I just thought that that was ridiculous, because if I had a problem with alcohol, I thought everybody I knew had a problem, because I didn't associate with people who didn't drink the way that I drank. I mean, why would I bother? You know? So I know that I didn't take him seriously. It just seemed like nonsense to me. So I went from Turkey to Spain, to Torrejon, Spain, and I met a girl that she liked to drink too. Everybody I met liked to drink. You know, if I met you and you didn't like to drink, I didn't really meet you. You know, I'd go meet somebody else. So we decided we were going to go to Alcalá and drink wine. I don't know what else we drank, but I remember we drank wine. And one of us had the brilliant idea that we could go back to the base and go to a movie for a dollar. And we were pretty drunk. And so she said, I said, "I'm drunk, so you drive my car." And I had a 64 VW Bug. It was really ugly. It was yellow and black. It looked like a beat up bumblebee. I said, "That's okay, you drive." So we get to the base and she goes, "I don't have my ID." And I said, "It's okay, use mine." And so we tried to go on the base. I don't recommend this, okay? We tried to go on the base. My friend was a lot shorter than I am. She had tight curly hair, a pointy nose, and glasses and freckles. And I looked like me, just a little bit younger, a lot younger. And we didn't look anything alike. And she used my ID, and they said, "No, that's not going to work." And then they took us to the hospital and took our blood to see what was wrong with us. I don't remember getting in trouble for doing that, because I wasn't on duty, I wasn't at work, I wasn't breaking a law, I wasn't driving the car, I didn't pay a consequence for that. But you know, I've heard other people tell similar stories, and they paid a really harsh consequence for their behavior, and I didn't for doing that. But so while I was in Spain, I had a friend. I played softball when I was in Turkey on the base team, and we had gone to Spain to play in the regional playoffs. And one of the girls on my team, her former roommate was now stationed at Torrejon, and she was a bartender. And so when we went to play softball, my teammate said, let's go over and see if my friend's working and she'll buy us all a drink. So we went over and she was there, and she and I became friends, good friends, we're still friends. And anyway, she was tending bar, and there was this guy sitting at the end of the bar, and he was doing shots of tequila with lime and salt, and I thought he was kind of cute. And so I didn't go, I was gonna go help her, and we were gonna go somewhere, and I didn't. I was more interested in paying attention to this guy, and he was pretty drunk, and I'm not gonna tell you his story, that's his story. But anyway, he was a nice looking guy, and we've been married for 33 years, so. Anyway, I was just telling you about that because we met in a bar, and that seemed so convenient for me. Like when we started dating, I went to his office one time, and I was sitting at his desk, and I opened a drawer right here, and he had a bottle of Jack Daniels in his desk at work, and I thought, this is gonna be fine because, you know, my drinking is not going to bother him. You know, I like that, you know. So anyway, we got out of the Air Force and we went to Arizona. We had three children. And I was really good to myself when I was pregnant, when I was having children. I wasn't really good to myself. I was good to my children. I thought the alcohol would hurt them, so I had a pretty good motivator not to drink. But as soon as my youngest child was old enough to not need my hand 24/7, I was back drinking daily. And so I'm kind of coming forward a little bit. When my daughter was not 9 years old, my oldest, I thought to prove that I didn't have a drinking problem, I'd give up drinking for Lent. And seemed easy enough, you know, except that it wasn't. And we went with some friends, we went on a trip, and the guy went in, my friend's husband went in to get something to drink, and he came out and he had some sodas for the children and some beers for the adults, and handed me one, and I started drinking it, and my daughter looked at me with daggers in her eyes, and I knew she was mad, you know, wasn't sure why she was so mad, but I could tell she was pretty mad. So when we got home, I asked her why she was so mad, and she looked at me and said, you broke your promise to God. So I try to tell that story sometimes because what that showed me wasn't that I had a problem with alcohol. It showed me that my daughter had a problem with alcohol. And so the best way to fix it would be to hide my liquor. You know, and if she didn't see it, then it wouldn't bother her and then it wouldn't be a problem. So that's, you know, I recognize that today as good alcoholic thinking, but you know, at the time it made sense to me, you know. So my favorite place to hide my liquor was wherever you didn't already find it. You know, that was my favorite place. And one of those favorite places was in my laundry room. You know, when I first came to AA, I heard a guy say, we all come from the same alley, we just come from different trash cans. And I was like, I don't like that. That sounds kind of, really? I don't want to come from a trash can, you know. But then one day I heard a lady say, we all come from the same laundry room, we just come from different laundry baskets. And I thought that was funny because I did a lot of laundry in my life. You know, I could identify with that. And I used to hide my liquor in the trash that I put the lint in, because nobody else was going to look in there. So I'd pick up the lint and put my bottle in there. And then I'm sure somebody found it one day, and so I thought, okay, I'll hide it in the dryer. And I did. And, you know, I hid my liquor out. I mean, all my family had to do was go in the laundry room, and they'd probably find some somewhere, because I hid it all over the place. And anyway. Okay, so near the end of my drinking, I used to wonder if there was anything that I could do about this problem that I finally realized that I had with alcohol. And my answer was no. There wasn't anything I could do, that I'd probably die drunk, because there's not really anything that I can do. That's not because I want to die, not because I have a death wish. I just don't know how to not drink. And I drank every day until I blacked out. If I had a way to get more, if I had a means, even if that meant stealing it, if I had a means, I would get more. Even if I don't remember, I'd go in a blackout and get more. So in my brilliance, one day, I went to the Walmart, the Walgreens, and I asked the lady at the in the liquor section not to sell me liquor anymore, like it's her fault, you know, like, you know, great thinking, you know, like, please don't sell me this anymore, you know, and then just go across the street, because I didn't tell them yet not to sell me any, you know. So my daughter, when she was 9, when she told me I broke my promise to God and I started hiding my liquor, when she was 15, I quit drinking when she was 15, so you know I'm getting to the end of my drinking story. I had a job where I had to make deliveries, and I lived in the desert, and I didn't have a cell phone. And I had drivers who were supposed to make these deliveries, and if they didn't, then I had to fill in where they didn't. So I had to deliver these papers way out in the desert, and I had a bottle of Southern Comfort. So I got in my car, and I drive out to the desert, and I pass this sign. I'm not making this up. I pass this sign that says, "Trespassers will be shot." That's a part of the desert that I was in. And I came up to this address where I had to deliver these papers. I did not pull off to the side of the road. I just stopped in the road, put my car in park, picked up the papers, jumped out of the car, looked back at the car, and went, uh-oh. I'd locked my keys in the car. The car was still running, and I could see the bottle of Southern Comfort, and I hadn't even bothered to pull off to the side of the road. So I was afraid if somebody came to help me, I would get in trouble. Well, I don't know what you would do to solve that problem, but I thought the best thing to do would be to pick up a river rock and break my window. So I attempted to do that, and it's kind of hard to break your window. So nothing happened when I hit it the first time. So I thought that I just had to hit it harder. And I'm kind of stubborn sometimes. So the second time that I hit it, it did break, and it also severed this tendon in this finger. And so when I went like this, it was like that. So that kind of scared me, and I cut a little blood vessel, and the blood vessel was gurgling a little bit. There's no nerve, so you can't. It didn't hurt, it just scared me because it didn't look right. And so I brushed all the glass away from around my window so you wouldn't know that I broke it. And I just, you know, brilliant thinking, right? Brush all the glass away. What happened to your window, Winona? Yeah, you know, I don't know, it's not there anymore. So I drove myself to the nearest emergency medical facility, and they told me they could fix my hand. I didn't have to go to the hospital. They could do it right there, and they did, and you know, I have my hand back, so I was fortunate. A lot of bad things could have happened to me that didn't happen to me yet, and I don't know why. I don't know how to answer that. I can tell you that AA has taught me some things that I never knew I would learn about gratitude and about belief and about acceptance and about compassion and about strength and about sharing, you know, that I never knew was going to happen. And so I'm here right now to tell you my story about what happened, like what it was like first and then what happened and what it's like now. And so what happened is I would drink, as I told you, until I blacked out almost every day. And I lived in a master planned community in right outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And I went to the store to get some more liquor, and I came back to the house, and I tried to go in the house, and I couldn't get in. So I tried harder to get in. Now, this time I did have a cell phone with me. So I tried to get in the house, and I still couldn't get in the house, so I tried harder. And I wasn't, like, trying to break the window this time. I was just trying to get in the house. And I couldn't get in the house. And the people who were in the house were getting annoyed with me because I was trying to get in the house. So they called the police because it wasn't my house. So the police came, and I had my cell phone, and they were able to use my cell phone and call my husband and say, could you please come get your wife? She's being a nuisance. And I can also tell you that I don't remember this happening, that I went to the wrong house. I have no memory of it. But my husband took me home, and the next morning he said, do you know what happened last night? And I said, no. And he told me what happened as best as he understood. And I went downstairs, and my 9-year-old, who's now 15 years old, said, do you know what happened last night? And I said, yes, which was kind of a lie. But my husband had just told me what happened as he understood it, so I could tell her I knew what happened. And she said to me, well, I wish you had gotten arrested, because then maybe you'd do something about your problem. So that wasn't the last time I got drunk. I called a doctor that day, and actually I called a friend of mine who was a social worker who I knew might be able to help me, maybe, at least in theory. At least if I ever had whatever it is, it gets us to ask for help. I don't know why that's so difficult for some of us, but I knew that if I ever asked somebody, that would be the person I would ask. And so I called her, and she said, I think I know somebody who can help you. And he was a doctor, and the doctor asked me if I would go to detox. And I said, yes. Do I have to go right now? And he said, no, tomorrow's okay. So I went and got drunk. And that was my last drunk. I went and got drunk, and then the next day I went to detox, and I haven't gotten drunk since then. So when I went to detox for 2.5 days, it was a Saturday and a Sunday and a Monday, so I didn't lose my job. I worked in an elementary school. And the doctor told me when I got out of detox, he wanted me to come back and talk to him, and I did. And he said, are you willing to go to any length? And I didn't really know what that meant, like AA language. I didn't know what that meant. I just knew that I was asking him for help, so I knew I was willing to ask for help. So he said, will you do whatever you're told? And I said, if it doesn't hurt. And no, he wanted a different answer. You know, he wanted to know if I was serious. And when I, you know, I thought I understood, he wanted a different answer. So I said, yes, I'll do whatever I'm told. I'll do whatever I'm asked. So he said, I want you to go to an AA meeting. And so I went to this one. I'm just telling you in case you ever have been there or if you ever get a chance to go. It was called You Can Too. It scared the heck out of me. I thought everybody in there needed as much help as I did. I just kind of mumbled, to the best of my ability, and somebody said hello, and I just probably went, you know, I don't know what I did. It was scary, and I might not have gone back because it was scary. And anyway, I said I would go back, so I did. I went to the same place, the same scary place, in the evening, and it wasn't as scary. And there were different people in the same room, but different people, and some of them looked friendly. And a guy at the end of the meeting came up to me and asked me if I had a directory, and I said no. And he said, don't you leave until I come back with a directory. His name was Mike, and he had really long hair, like down to his waist, gray hair. And he brought me a directory, and he said, find a meeting that is comfortable for you and go. And I thought, you know, he doesn't even know me. That was nice. He's just giving me some good orderly direction because I certainly didn't know how to give myself any. So I took that directory and I looked for a meeting. This meeting was probably about 25 miles from my house. And I found that there were a lot of meetings in Phoenix, and a lot of them were a lot closer to my house. So I found a different meeting, and I went to it. It was called Breath of Fresh Air. And that became my home group. And so I'll tell you what it's like now. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody suggested to me to get a notebook so that I could remember some things that might be important. So I did. I still have the notebook, and I wrote, I just wrote down how I felt, whether I was happy or sad or good or bad or whatever. I wrote it down. I really, really wanted to try to be a good girl, and I didn't know how to be. You know, I just didn't know how to be, but I wanted to try. So somebody told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. The doctor actually told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I thought I was the only person who ever heard that, and didn't know if I could, but thought I would give it my best shot. I did go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I heard somebody, when I was in detox, one of the ladies gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me to read it. And when I went to that first meeting at Breath of Fresh Air, somebody told me to read the first 164 pages. So I got my little notebook and I wrote, read the first 162 pages. And I still have the notebook and it still says 162. So, you know, who knows what else I got wrong, you know, but I tried. So I went to a lot of meetings and I tried to listen and I tried to understand. I still try to understand, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but I try. And to me, intention is half the battle. You know, if I try to do something that I don't think I can do, I probably can't do it because I don't think I can. But if I try anyway, I might change my mind. And there's some kind of miracle in there. You know, if I try to do something that I don't think I can do, and then I find out that I can do it, there's some kind of miracle in there too. You know, because I didn't drink today. And before I got to AA, that did not happen. I could not do it by myself. I tried, but I failed miserably. So I'll tell you about some things that I think I've learned in AA. If you haven't already noticed, I love AA. I feel like it saved my life. It gave me back me. I'm a better version of me than I used to be. I believe that. And I believe that I've met other people in AA that I've observed become better versions of themselves. It's like, you know, we say it's like a we program. I've watched people become better people. And I trust the people that I'm close to in AA more than anybody anywhere. I'd put us up against anybody, anywhere, anytime, because of our intention to be better versions of ourselves. We're nicer to ourselves, we're nicer to each other, we're more cooperative than we probably ever imagined we could be, and it's genuine. So if you don't believe me, stick around, because it is genuine, and I'm not the only one that talks the way that I'm trying to talk right now, because I learned this from listening to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about the possibility if I just try. So I try. And so I have a little bit more time, right? So, okay, most of you probably already know that the first step is about powerlessness. What I was trying to tell you about the way that I drank is I was trying to show you that I was powerless. That whether I knew it or not, I was powerless. And it had a hold on me that I didn't understand and didn't think I could do anything about. And I would pray to God. I would get on my knees and I would pray to God and say, please help me control my drinking. Because I didn't quite understand that if I just stopped, it might take care of some of my problems. And I wasn't prepared to stop because I was powerless. I wanted to drink anyway, even with all the problems that it brought. I wanted to drink. So that powerlessness, you know, recognizing that I'm powerless, for me, it's not just powerlessness over alcohol, it's powerlessness over people, places, and things. Like, the only thing that I am in charge of, the only thing, is my next action. It's the only thing I'm in charge of. I'm not even in charge of how I feel, because I might get really happy, or I might get really sad, or I might get really mad, and I'm not really in charge of that. You know, have you ever been like so happy or so mad, you just like not really in charge of it? I'm not in charge of that, but I am in charge of what I do about it. And I feel like AA has helped me understand that better than I used to, that I'm only in charge of my next action. So I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm not powerless over how I conduct myself. So believing in a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, I didn't think that I had a problem believing in a power greater than myself. I'm comfortable with the concept that there's a power bigger than me. But I really took offense, and I try to talk about it because I try to be honest about it. I took offense to restore me to sanity, because if I looked at that and I was honest about it, I had to consider that maybe my behavior was less than sane in order to need to be restored. And that offended me, because I didn't want to think I was crazy or that my behavior was really bad, or, you know, I didn't want to look at that. I did not want to be honest about it. You know, I just like, if I don't talk about it, maybe it'll go away. But it doesn't go away. It just gets more complicated and more icky, you know. So I think that I am a person who believes in a power greater than myself, but that belief, you know, it's like, it's alive, that belief is alive, so sometimes it's bigger and sometimes it's smaller, and sometimes my faith is strong, sometimes it's, you know, really big, and sometimes my faith isn't that big. Sometimes I have more doubt, and I let my fear get the best of me, and I forget that I can have courage even in the face of fear. You know, that happens too. But so the belief, you know, believing in a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, I'm a little bit better now about owning up that my behavior was less insane sometimes, like when I broke my windshield, you know, that was not really sane behavior, you know. Or if I blame my daughter for my drinking, or tell the clerk, you know, don't sell me liquor, those kind of behaviors are like, you know, that's not like normal, healthy behavior, you know. And I could tell you a lot of other stories, you know, that show evidence that my behavior was less than rational. I don't think it's really necessary. I think I made that point. Turning my will over to a God of my understanding, I already kind of touched on that a little bit, that, you know, I try to the best of my ability to thy will be done, God's will, not my will. And one of the things that AA has helped me with is I thought for a long, long time before I came to AA, I thought that there was a power greater than myself, but my understanding of that power was very different from your understanding. And because my understanding was different, it was not acceptable. So there must be something wrong with me. And that was really an issue for me. I didn't want to talk to you about it. I didn't want to say it out loud. It's a little bit embarrassing. But my faith was not as strong as I thought it was. Because if it was, that would not have bothered me. It wouldn't have bothered me. But, you know, I'm not all that. You know, I can pretend, but I'm not really all that. You know, so I'm just me. I'm me who believes in a power greater than myself that can restore me, and that I can give my will to that power, and I just might end up having a better day than if I didn't do that. That's what I get out of the first three steps. And if I do the first three steps, if I try to live them the way I just described every day, I am a better version of myself. I'm less judgmental. I'm less greedy. I'm less selfish. I'm more compassionate. I'm more cooperative. I'm a little more humble, maybe. And I get that from AA, like a gift. I get that from AA. So steps 4 and 5, if I am honest about some of the things I've done in my life, you know, this is how I think about the fourth step. I could take a long time, but I'm not going to. If there's something in my past that I lose sleep over, that I think about, I go back to it, and that person hurt me so bad, and I hate them so much, and if I had a pin, I'd stick it in the doll, and I'd say what a creep that person was. When I do that, whoever it is that I think harmed me, that's making me do that, they're not doing that to me. I'm doing that to me. One person may have brought that about a long, long time ago that causes me to have feelings that I don't like in myself. But to bring it back over and over again, that person doesn't do that. I do that to me. So when I harm myself like that, I'm making the world a more complicated place. So for me, step 4 is about being honest about my fears and my frustrations and my resentments, and writing them down so I can see it, so it's real, so it's tangible, and then sharing it with another person who I trust, who can help me see my part in my behaviors, in my interactions, so that I can have better relationships with the people in my world. That's how I see 4 and 5. So step 6 is being prepared to give my character defects to God. And in the 12 and 12, it says that step 6 is the step that makes the difference between the men and the boys. And I always tangle with this in my mind, you know. Now, wait a minute here. You know, what do you mean, where do I fit in there? You know, so the way that I see step 6 is no hitch. Like, I'm either in it or I'm not. No hesitation. Like, I'm either offering my will to a God of my understanding, or I'm full of bull. Oh, you said watch my profanity. So you know, I'm either in it or I'm not. And I want to be in it. And I want to be held accountable. And I don't know about you, but I'm not telling your story. I'm telling my story. And my story is I want to be held accountable to myself, to my Creator, and to my fellows. So I want to be prepared for God to relieve me of my character defects, knowing that it's probably not going to happen. But at least I can be in the frame of mind that I'm willing to let go of some of my more despicable behaviors. So 7, to me, 6 and 7 go hand in hand. And 7 is just actually saying the prayer to ask God to take them. So 8 is making amends, saying I'm sorry for the things that I've done. Not just I'm sorry, but how can I make it right? How can I make it so that I don't make those same kinds of problems in, you know, from here on out? And 9, so 8 is like writing down who I need to say I'm sorry to, and 9 is actually saying I'm sorry or making an amends. And for me, if I just run out and say I'm going to do that myself, I'm probably going to make a mess of it. So I hope I have somebody on my side willing to listen to me and help me and guide me and be strength for me when I'm not strong enough to help me do a better job than I would if I tried to do it alone. So I don't recommend anybody doing it alone, but I don't mean to tell you what to do. I'm just saying that's how I read 8 and 9. So I've heard 10 and 11 and 12 are called the maintenance steps. The way that I look at 10 is keep my side of the street clean. At the end of the day, look at what I've done. Could I have done anything better? Can I fix it? Can I do it better tomorrow? Can I be a better version of me? Well, if I have conscious contact, improved conscious contact with the God of my understanding, then the answer probably is yes. And if I have an improved conscious contact with the God of my understanding, the Big Book tells me that I will have a spiritual awakening as a result of all of those steps. And if I have that spiritual awakening, how can I not be a better version of me? And I didn't get to, from where I started, when I started telling you my story tonight, I didn't get from there to where I just ended by myself. I did not get here by myself. I got here with help, with hope and strength and experience from all of my AA fellows who are willing to carry a message that could give us a better life. Thanks for letting me share.